Now, people often think that for a performer, bombing on stage is the worst thing. It's not. The worst thing is knowing you will soon go on stage and bomb and there is nothing you can do about it. Somehow, I got looped into this charity event with comedians and musicians and all super talented people, the best people. And one by one, they go onto the stage of a beautiful theater and they bomb. Spectacularly. No audience member laughs. No one claps. Instead, they look angry and hungry and murderous. Backstage, I watch this horror-struck. We send our brave comrades out one at a time as peace offerings, only to see their genius crushed. A funny woman, a very funny woman, says, "Look, there's nothing to be done about it. Harry Houdini couldn't get a rise out of the audience tonight. Sometimes the stage just goes dead." Yeah, but I gotta go on soon. What do I do? And she says, "It's easy. Turn around, open the door, and walk away." And it had never occurred to me. She's right. I can leave. I'm a grown man. I don't need this. I start toward the door to make my escape, but then I see them. The fallen. Those who've braved that stage and lived to tell the tale. They're gathering around, sharing a bottle of whiskey, recounting the experience to each other, laughing, hugging, shaking their heads, taking long pulls from the bottle, bonded by fire. And them, there, that is a club I want to join. So, I stick my chest out, turn around, and walk onto the stage. Today, on Snap Judgment, from WNYC Studios, we proudly present Down with the Ship. Amazing stories from real people who decide to see things through to the bitter end. My name is Glenn Washington. Please remember to tip your waitresses because you're listening. Listen to Snap Judgment. For our first story today, we're going on vacation. So put your feet up, enjoy a nice piña colada, and just relax because it's all inclusive. Everything is taken care of, we promise.
Okay, so let's start out this story with a request.
I haven't played it in so many...
This guy you're hearing is Moss Hills.
And the sun beats down on the tar up on the roof. Wait, give me a second.
He'll be our entertainment for the evening, a musician of many years.
Under the boardwalk.
But we're looking for a different song.
First line start, Yeah, that's right. It's, you know, Old Man River, he got nothing to lose.
Because, you see, Moss isn't just any musician, no. He is a cruise ship entertainer.
And won't you let me take you on a sea cruise, a sing ooh-wee? You know, we just get the party going, and everyone throws streamers, and I do sing-along songs and conga lines, and it's a fantastic vibe. I love doing it.
For Moss, working as a musician on a cruise ship, it never felt like settling.
When you're working to an audience on a cruise ship, every single person in the audience is on holiday. No one's driving to work the next day. All your tired old jokes work every time. It's just a perfect venue. Ooh-wee, baby, won't you let me take you on a sea cruise?
Moss was actually in a duo with his wife, Tracy. He played guitar, she played bass. It was kind of like they were on vacation. Forever. Even when things went wrong, they could be fun. Memorable. Take this time they were on this ship called the Oceanus. And they were expected to host this wedding off the coast of South Africa. Only they were in a really bad storm.
And so they do the ceremony. People are walking in and supposed to be this quite moving thing as the bride's walking up the aisle and her father's giving her away and the guests are all standing, but they're all rocking to the left and then rocking to the right. And it looks like some macabre, weird dance. This whole room's doing it. And I hid behind the flowers with a sick bag so that every now and again the organist could lean over, look at me, and I'd quickly rush the bag out, shove it up to his face, he'd vomit into the bag. And then go back to da 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 da. And it was ridiculous.
The only problem is that the next day, the wedding was over, but the storm wasn't. In fact, it was only getting worse.
And it was so rough that we could see the waiters trying to serve food to the guests, and in fact, food and trays were falling over, and that has never happened with me on a ship before. And eventually nobody was laughing. People were just starting to get tense. And then all the lights went out. And the ship was just plunged into darkness. And standing there in the lounge in the dark, the little emergency lights came on, but they're very dim. And, you know, the ship feels suddenly so eerie. And some of the people who were already in the lounge were sort of shouting out, "What's happening?" You know, and I went over to some of them and saying, "Look, just sit tight, everything's going to be right." And I was making a joke and saying, "We forgot to pay the electricity bill, you know, we're going to pay it and it'll come back on." And whilst I was saying all that, we heard the engine stop. And I thought, this is now starting to become something dangerous. I was worried what was happening.
The passengers were worried too. Without being told, people were emerging from their cabins and dining areas and congregating at the natural meeting point of the ship, the Four Seasons Lounge, which is where Moss was.
And they were just milling around. And then I thought, well, I better try and be on stage and try and focus people's attention. And I had an acoustic guitar, so I just started saying, "Don't worry, it'll all get sorted out soon. Let's just stay in here, we'll have a bit of fun." And I just started singing a few songs. And I remember doing a little bit of Don McLean's American Pie, and we got to that part of the chorus which goes,
"And good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye and singing, this'll be the day that I die."
And Tracy and I looking at each other and thought, let's not do that one. I just went straight into the Beatles.
"Ooh, I need your love, babe."
It's amazing, actually. I think that I can't find the right song for this audience. Just play the Beatles, and it's incredible. They just sing along wherever you are. That band is just phenomenal. Anyway, people were sort of singing along, and I kept expecting an officer in white to come striding in and tell us what was going on, or to hear ding dong, and over the PA system, "This is the captain from the bridge with some announcement." But absolutely nothing was happening. And I could perceive now the ship was lurching and leaning more to the starboard side. It wasn't recovering, coming back level again. And I tell you, it doesn't matter how good an entertainer you are, or you think you are, people just want to know what's going on. So I went to Tracy and quietly, without passengers hearing us, I said to her, "Look, I need to go and try and find somebody in authority." And she said to me, "Well, you know, Moss, please don't do anything stupid." I said, no, I won't. I need to find out what's happening."
Moss wasn't necessarily looking for the captain at this point. He's mainly looking for his boss, the cruise director. But when he found her, she was speaking to the captain.
And the captain was telling her that the storm was really bad and that he wanted to start to abandon the ship. And that's when I interjected and said, "Well, why are we going to abandon the ship?"
Which, of course, Moss wasn't supposed to do. He was the guitarist. The captain was the captain.
And I could see the cruise director look at me a little bit in amazement, and the captain just kind of looks right through me. I mean, I'm of no consequence to him at all.
The captain briefly explained to Moss that they were abandoning the ship as a precaution.
And I said, "Well, are we sinking?" He said, "No." I said, "Is there a fire?" He said, "No." But, I mean, you know, you can't argue with the captain, but I just did not believe that you would not make people abandon the ship and go into a black, dark night and a terrible storm in rickety little lifeboats if you didn't absolutely have to. And so I left and I thought, I need to see what is the danger that we are supposedly abandoning the ship for. I went and found a friend of mine, Julian.
And Julian, just in case you're wondering, was one of the onboard magicians.
Julian was always very good at close-up magic, and he had some great outfits, because when he's on stage, you can't take your eyes off him. He's just constantly changing capes and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, I said to Julian, "Let's just go right down to the lowest area of the ship that we can." So we're going down the staircases, hanging onto the railings, being thrown from side to side, and going deeper and deeper into the ship until we got to an area called the shaft tunnel.
The shaft tunnel is basically the rock bottom of the ship. It's where the propeller shafts run through the vessel. Kind of this long hallway where normally you would hear the shafts spinning. But now it was just dark and silent.
And as the ship rides up over a wave and then crashes down into the trough, well, that next wave hits it and the whole ship shudders. And that's somewhat disconcerting. So we started walking forward until we came across one of the watertight doors and it was closed. Now, the watertight door wouldn't be closed unless there was good reason to do that. And I remember putting my ears up against the door, and they're very, very thick metal. But I could hear water pounding the other side of that door. And now suddenly you do feel fear. And you know, fear can be a physical kind of feeling. You feel it, you know, deep in your stomach. And I remember us both thinking, oh my word, we're sinking.
And when he and Julian emerged from the shaft tunnel, it was pandemonium.
And we could hear crew sort of shouting in six different languages and utter disarray. And Julian and I were trying to ask questions. We were just being ignored. Lots of the crew were grabbing small bags and getting themselves packed up.
And at this point, there still hadn't been any announcement from the captain. The passengers were all still in the lounge or in their cabins, just waiting. So Moss and Julian went right back to the lounge and got all the entertainers together.
And then I said, look, I know for sure the captain is not telling us the truth. I can't wait for announcements any longer. We need to try and start getting people into lifeboats.
This is the part where I imagine Moss turning stoically to all the passengers assembled in the lounge and saying, come with me if you want to live. But Moss says it didn't really work like that.
I think they were somewhat taken aback that this sort of instruction was coming from a guitar player and a magician and various other of the entertainers. But there was nobody else.
And if you're wondering how to stage a mass evacuation of 600 people from a sinking ocean liner, you're not alone. Moss and the other entertainers, they didn't know either.
There are master keys, but I had no idea where the master keys are. We also considered trying to make an announcement ourselves, but I didn't know where to do it. I didn't know what buttons to push or even where those buttons were. So we started banging on doors, just waking people up.
Then there was the matter of how to work the actual lifeboats.
Because you're supposed to attach the lifeboats to the side of the ship, and we did not know how to do that. But now the ship was tipping over so much on the starboard side that as you lower that lifeboat, it swings away from the ship, and then it comes rushing back towards it and smacks into the steel hull. And the people inside the lifeboat were now starting to squeal and shout in fear and shock as it hit the side of the ship, and then it would swing out again and hit again.
And you have to keep in mind that during all this, officers and crew were mixed up with the passengers, trying to get into the lifeboats themselves.
But once they were in the lifeboat, they were shouting, right, launch, launch, launch. And, you know, Julian was asking, well, we need to put more people. How many are supposed to go in? No, it's full, lower the lifeboat. And these guys are not even trying to get as many people in as possible. As soon as they're in it, they just want to go.
Still, they hadn't seen the captain leave the ship. And so when the last of the usable lifeboats left, Moss and the other entertainers went up to the bridge.
And of course, the bridge is also in darkness like the rest of the ship, but there's all of the controls and instruments and radar panels are all on and the lights are all glowing and flickering, but we couldn't see anybody. And suddenly we're sort of turning to each other and realizing there's nobody on the bridge. They must have abandoned us. And we still had a little over 200 people left on board.
At this point, the ship itself was in a bad way. It had sunk all the way down to its upper decks and was getting hit broadside by the waves.
So we thought, well, if we just start calling Mayday on one of the radios, we're hopefully going to get hold of someone.
Do you even know what frequency?
No, but we decided let's not change any controls or any dials because whatever it is that these guys do on the bridge, well, they must have been doing it. And I'm assuming that one of those channels must still be set. So I was calling on the radio, Mayday, 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 please help us. And then letting go, listening for a reply, Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. And that's when we heard a voice saying,
okay, okay.
And we thought, oh, thank goodness that somebody'd reply. You know, now someone's going to come and rescue us. And he just kept saying,
okay, okay, what's your position?
So I said, we're about halfway between the port of East London
and Durban, and it's off the sort of northern part of the southeast coast of South Africa. And he said,
No, what's your position? What are your coordinates?
I said, well, I don't know what the coordinates are. And him sort of snapping back and saying,
well, what rank are you?
And me saying, well, I'm not a rank, I'm a guitar player.
After taking a moment to process, the officer on the other ship helped Moss contact the South African Navy so that they could locate the Oceanus and send out some choppers. But to help with that, they really wanted Moss to find the captain, the one who was still on board, somewhere.
And underneath one of the staircases that leads down to the swimming pool area, I saw the captain and the radio officer, both sort of kind of hiding in the shadows there and just smoking. And I remember thinking, wow, you know. And so I said, Captain, can you come to the bridge? We've managed to make contact with ships. If you can come there and just help us and give instructions. And he was just smoking and saying, no, it's not necessary. And I was, yes, you know, we need you to come to the bridge. We can't answer the questions. And he just kept saying, no, it's not necessary. He just seemed to have completely given up. He didn't look panicked. He didn't look anything. He looked vacant. And I just left him there.
A short while later, a chopper appeared on the horizon. Moss didn't need the captain anymore. He had the Navy. The Oceanus had been found.
And when those Navy divers came on deck, it did feel like now finally somebody's on board who's going to be in charge and they're going to take over here. But they said, look, we don't think we can get everybody off. Simple as that.
For the divers, it was just pure math. There was too many people and not enough time. They said that if they brought in a second chopper, they just might be able to get everyone hoisted off the ship before it sank. But they told Moss that because they didn't have enough manpower, he would have to work one of the two rescue lines, putting passengers into a harness.
And I was really very, very concerned. You know, I didn't really want to do this because, you know, suddenly it just felt very different to everything else that we've been doing so far. And because they said, if you get it wrong, they'll drop from that harness and hit the deck and be probably killed, or they might just be dropped into the water and just swept away. So you've got to get this right each time, and you've got to do it fast.
And don't forget, this is all on a windy, pitching, tilted, sinking ship.
And I knew that if we split the people in half, that I was going to have to rescue 114 people through this method.
Moss was stuck between a rock and a hard place. Once they started hoisting people up, Tracy did a great job keeping people in line. But when Moss tried to clip them into the harness too quickly, they would slide down the deck and he would have to go rescue them. That ended up costing him a lot of time. But when he tried to go slowly, carefully, that cost him time too. He felt like he was failing.
And as we've hoisted two elderly ladies, I misjudged the waves and a big wave hit the ship. And the whole ship lurched, and as they swung out, these ladies just hit the side of the ship with a smack. And then they just hung in those harnesses like rag dolls.
The chopper continued to hoist the two women up, but Moss had no way of knowing whether they were okay. It was the first time someone got hurt who he felt responsible for.
And I lost my nerve for a while. I just couldn't put anybody else in the harness, so I signaled Tracy just to hang on. And I remember turning my back to the railing and sitting there and just looking down the steep deck, going away from my feet as I sat there and the water below me, and just thinking that this is just too much. There's still so many people left to rescue. I know we're going to lose people. Who's going to go? Who's going to be lost? And who's going to, are we going to save? But there was no choice. You just you've got to do it. You can't let the sort of the enormity of it sort of encroach on the basic drive of we're getting off here. So I got back up off the deck and then told Tracy to send more people out to me, and it was just focused on making it happen. And you know, in that sort of time of real crisis, so many of those passengers thanked me, which I just found remarkable. And I remember them saying to me, careful of your fingers, you need to play guitar. And you know, two became four, became six, and then suddenly we realized there was no one else left except for the Navy diver and just Tracy and I, and it was finally our chance to get rescued. And we looked at each other, and then we didn't say a word. That cable came taut, pulled us off the deck, and as the helicopter was pulling away, I remember just looking down at my ship
drowning in front of me. It's hard to explain. I really don't know why, but I felt a very strong attachment to the ship that I've not felt to other ships. I've been on so many ships before and after. But that Oceanus, when I saw her as we flew away, I felt like I was abandoning her. And as we came to land, I remember one of the military people saying to me, "Is everybody off?" And me saying, "Yes, everybody's off. It's all over." And I said that, and I just couldn't stand. And I remember I started to sob. I just couldn't control it. And I just collapsed.
Moss and the other entertainers had saved every single passenger, over 400 people, including the people on the lifeboats and the two elderly ladies. They were pretty bruised up, but they were okay. Just about the only thing Moss couldn't save was the Oceanus herself. He didn't get to see her sink, but a news chopper managed to capture her final moments. This is the actual audio from that tape.
And I've seen that footage many, many times, and it can see exactly where I was running my rescue station from, and I can just see that just go underwater. I can then see the section where Tracy was keeping all the passengers organized. I can see that bit go underwater. Then the whole stern of the ship just lifts right out of the water until it's vertically in the air, and it just slowly just nosedives completely down. And finally, you can just see debris and orange life jackets and bits of deck chair and so on just literally being blown into the air by this enormous roar of air. It's like a great beast just giving its last gasp of breath. And suddenly, the Oceanus is gone. And there's not even a ripple. It just disappears and the waves carry on and the ocean just shrugs.
Moss never lost his love of the sea. After the sinking of the Oceanus, he and Tracy continued to work the cruise lines. And today, Moss is a cruise director. He says that most captains take him pretty seriously. But he still insists on playing guitar at least one night every voyage. If you ask, he might even sing you that sea cruise song, only with a twist.
I took that tune and I wrote a song to tell the story of what happened with the Oceanus sinking. So this is my Oceanus song.
Here's my story of the Oceanus and how that ship became world famous. I'll tell you it straight, I won't tell a lie, and it's a sad, sorry story, so try not to cry. We sang, "Mayday, mayday, get me to the shore, 'cause the ship's gonna sink." Well, in the age-old tradition, it was women and children first.
Thank you so much to Moss Hill for sharing his story with The Snap. Now, there are so many details about that night that we weren't able to include, so we want to be sure to thank the members of the Oceanus entertainment team who helped during the rescue, including, but not limited to, Moss's wife and bandmate Tracy, the cruise director Lorraine, both of the onboard magicians Robin and Julian, the members of the Green Dolphin Show Band, and of course, the brave men and women of the South African Navy. And if you want to learn more about the Oceanus, we'll have links to the website Moss put together about this sinking, as well as to that video that he mentioned of the ship's final moments. All of it at snapjudgment.org. The original sound design was by Renzo Gorio, and that story was produced by Joe Rosenberg. Now, when Snap Judgment continues, a discovery you never want to make. When the Down the Ship episode returns, stay tuned. Welcome back to The Snap, the Down with the Ship episode. Today, we're examining what it means to commit to something or someone. And our next story takes place after the Vietnam War. Lots of soldiers have just come home, including Bill Babbitt's little brother, Manny.
I was working at Campbell Soup Company. My supervisor comes up to me, you know, I was a soup cook. He comes up to me, he says, "Bill Babbitt," he says, "you got somebody downstairs wants to see you." I go downstairs and there's my brother Manny with that dress blue uniform. Boy, I love that Marine Corps uniform. Stands out, catches all the girls, and makes America's enemies flee.
Manny is back from his second tour in Vietnam. He's out of work and his marriage just ended. So to get him back on his feet, Bill invites Manny to stay with him, his wife, and three kids in California.
When Manny came to live with me in Sacramento, I had high hopes. And now I got a kid brother who I know is going to be my best friend. We're going to have fun together. We're going to go shell fishing together, and we're going to play pool.
Bill figures he can help his baby brother find a job.
My wife Linda would take him out to job interviews, and she could hear him talking. She'd be in the other room. She could hear him laughing. He'd start talking about the war and talking instead of talking about what he could do for this company because he was in such bad shape. I went home one day early from work, and he comes up the street, and he's got a pair of black pants on, and he's got a pair of green shorts over the pants. He looked like a clown. I was very embarrassed by it. He had my bicycle, spokes festooned with flattened beer cans in between the spokes. And he's riding down there on my two wheels, and he's driving up my street. And I just hit the roof, and he says, "Manny, what the heck is going on?" He was off in limbo.
Manny did spend some time in a mental hospital after Vietnam, but Bill didn't have to deal with him until now.
He was always uptight, combative, ready to fight. One night, we got an argument about the safety features of the 45 caliber automatic. He says, "I was in the Marines, and you're going to tell me that you know more about the 45 than I do?" I says, "Well, Brother Manny," I says, "I had the 45 too." And I says, "What you said about the 45 is not true. That's not a safety." And he struck me on my chest and knocked me to the ground. I didn't get the Manny that I was expecting. I got a different Manny. I didn't know what to do about it. So finally, we resigned ourselves that we're going to have to take care of Manny for the rest of his life and forget about him getting work. I got a phone call from my wife. I was working at the railroad. I getting off at 11:30 at night. My wife calls me. She says, "Bill, did you give Manny any money?" I said, "No." He says, "Well, he's coming up with all these coins and he's giving money. They're going outside buying ice cream when the ice cream truck comes by." She says, "Something is wrong. You got to take a closer look." So I came home from the railroad at 11:30 that night. Here it is about 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm waiting for Manny to show up. So I go and get some Lemon Pledge. I get a rag. I go on to TV set and I start dusting. And I move around this little choo-choo piggy bank that I had sitting on the TV set. And the choo-choo bank was heavy and it was full of nickels. And I'm going, "Where did these nickels? They're not mine, nickels. I didn't put them in here. Did the kids put them in here? I don't know." I said, "Well, let me go into his closet where he keeps his stuff. Maybe he's got some loot there. I need to find out where he's getting money from. Is he doing burglaries or what is he doing, you know?" So I pushed aside this old leather jacket and I heard this thump. Something falls out of the coat, hits the floor. I reach down and pick it up. It's a cigarette lighter. It has the initials LS.
A couple days back, Bill had read this story in the newspaper about a robbery. An intruder had invaded the home of an elderly woman just back from Reno, where she played the nickel slots. The intruder beat her, sexually assaulted her, and she died of a heart attack. Her name was Leah Schindel.
And then I started thinking, and I go, "Wait a minute. Leah Schindel, nickels, cigarette lighter. A mile and a half from where I live, Manny Babbitt, my kid brother, was in big trouble." When it hit me, I was standing in front of the mirror. And I know what shock looks like in a person's face because I seen it in my face, the fear and the shock. Right away, your mouth gets dry. You don't know if you want to fight or run.
Bill thought about buying his brother a bus ticket out of town. Manny had been convicted of robbery before and got 8 years in prison, but was moved to a mental hospital for the criminally insane. Diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, Manny was released and eventually made his way to his brother's house. Bill figured he had started robbing again.
I've accepted the fact that he did it, and the reason why I know I felt that he did it is because I was afraid of him. I was reluctant to confront him about this. I know it was very delicate and very precarious. And I didn't want him to jump up and leave and disappear, to go off, to get away. I felt danger. I felt that maybe Manny would hurt somebody in my family. Oh my God, my heart was torn asunder. I went over to my wife. She's laying in the bed. And I got down on my knees first, and I said some prayers. I says, God, this is a nightmare. I've had enough of this nightmare. Wake me up. Give me a better dream. Let's try it again. When I picked up the phone, I told the cops, I says, my name is William Babbitt. I says, I think I know what happened to that lady up the street. I says, let me tell you about my brother Manny. When they brought me to the station, the cops interviewed me for 8 or 9 hours, and I cried like a baby, my God.
Bill told the police that Manny was at his sister's house, and together, they got into a couple of patrol cars and went to arrest his brother.
When we left that Sacramento police station for South Sacramento, it's about a 15 to 20 minute ride, and I was hoping it'd be like a 20 hour ride or 20 day ride.
The plan was for them to pull up to his sister's house. Bill would lure Manny peacefully into the hands of the police.
I said, my brother Manny's right up there, and I went upstairs. I says, brother Manny, I says, today is the day I'm gonna teach you how to play pool. I'm gonna give you some pool lessons today. I'm gonna beat you good. He fell for it. When we got outside, the rain would not stop. I didn't see any cops until we walked around these big hedges and they came out of nowhere. One guy had Manny by one arm, another guy had Manny by another arm. They asked him, is your name Manuel Pina Babbitt? He says, yes. He was just cool, calm, and collected. He didn't seem like he was nervous. He didn't seem like he was scared. He told the cops that he did not remember. The sad part was when they got Manny in the police car, I was away from Manny and I had tears was just flowing. And the cops asked me, he says, Bill, so we don't usually do this, but your brother's clean and we know you're clean. I says, he says, you could ride back there with him. I could not ride in the back of the police car with my brother Manny. I couldn't do it. I told the cops, I said, I can't do it. I can't handle it, you know. I don't want to get him upset if he sees me upset, you know. They asked me, you want to say something to him? So I said, yes. I went over and they rolled down the windows. He's sitting in the back of the car. He's handcuffed. And I went over to him. And I says, I love you, brother. I says, Manny, these are good cops. Don't give these guys no hard time, Manny. They're going to help you. We're going to fix you up, Manny. And when I got home, I had something to bring my family. Manny's going to go to a hospital. Sooner or later, when he gets well, he can come out. I felt that I was doing the right thing.
Police found Manny's fingerprints in Leah Schindel's home.
And Manny told me straight up, Brother Billy, I don't remember.
The night that Leah Schindel died, Manny had been hanging out with another war buddy. They were drinking and smoking angel dust. The next night, another woman reported that she had been robbed and sexually assaulted. A family friend identified a man that looked like Manny fleeing the scene. The district attorney charged Manny with first-degree murder and 2 counts of attempted rape and robbery. The DA decided to go for the death penalty.
What Manny said during his trial, that if they said he did it, then he must have did it.
Leah Schindel was discovered with a mattress over her head and a leather cord tied around her ankle. When a Marine is killed in combat, their comrades usually cover the body to protect it from damage. They tag the foot to identify the body, and then take keepsakes, like a lighter.
And I didn't think they was going to prove Manny was responsible for his act.
The jury found Manny guilty, and the judge sentenced him to death. While Manny's on death row, his case becomes politicized. His fellow veterans, his appeal lawyers, and Bill advocate for him. They fight for a retrial. When that's denied, they go for clemency.
I figured they would see that Manny was in a mental hospital. They would take into account his 2 tours of duty in Vietnam.
Manny's original lawyer didn't call any witnesses who served with him. He didn't bring up his history of mental illness or his military medical records. His new attorneys argued that he had a war flashback the night of the murder. Manny was in Khe Sanh during his first tour.
Khe Sanh, an Allied base manned by U.S. Marines and one battalion of South Vietnamese Rangers.
The 77-day siege was one of the longest and bloodiest battles in the Vietnam War. A rocket exploded, sending shrapnel into his skull. He suffered a severe head injury. By the next week, he was back on the battlefield. Manny's fellow veterans pushed for him to get a Purple Heart, for his bravery in the Battle of Khe Sanh. 30 years after Vietnam, Manny received his medal in a ceremony on death row. Immediately after, U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein declared that this was a sign of disrespect to the victim's family. She introduced a bill that banned people convicted of felonies from receiving military medals. A year later,
I got a phone call. It was the Sacramento County Public Defender's Office, Jessica McGuire. She says, "Bill, I hate to tell you this, Bill." She was crying. She says, "We lost. They're going to execute Manny. And he's got a death date now, and it's for May 3rd, 1999.
May 3rd, 1999 was Manny's 50th birthday. Bill heads to San Quentin to watch his brother's execution. His mother, sister, and brother-in-law are outside.
"I assured my mother, we're going to be all right. It's going to be all right now, Ma. Don't worry about it."
He's the only family member inside.
Several other people from this public defender's office were there. The Leah Shendell family was there, and they had the press were there. They pulled 50 years old Manny, and they lay him on a gurney, and he's just lying there. And I checked out his Adam's apple, see if he was any nervousness twitching. He was just cool, calm, and collected, like he was taking a nap.
I was standing at Manny's feet. So in the chamber, there's a red phone, and there was a delay. I felt the warden's going to call any minute now and say, "Clemency has been granted. Send Manny back to his cell." Everything is so quiet during that half hour. Nobody was speaking. You could just hear a pin drop. I knew that he had lost his appeal. There wasn't going to be no phone, nobody picking up a red phone from the governor.
It took about 5 minutes for Manny to die from lethal injection. And that's the moment it hit Bill.
I never thought they would kill Manny Babbitt. And now how am I going to face my family?
He knew they heard the death announcement outside, but he couldn't face his mother. So Bill left without saying a word, still thinking about Manny.
I remember the last conversation I had with Manny. He says, "Brother Billy," he says, "I want you to forgive these people who want me dead. I want you to forgive the Shendell family. I don't want you to go through life bitter and angry." And I says, "Brother Manny, people are going to be there. Find me, and our eyes will meet, and we'll lock on our eyes, and we'll pray together. We'll communicate together." And he told me, "No." He says, "I'm keeping my eyes closed, Brother Billy. I don't want to spend the rest of my life in prison. So I'm not going to open my eyes and check you out."
Many thanks to Bill Babbitt for sharing his story with Snap. Please be sure to check out the documentary Last Day of Freedom. We'll have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. The original sound design was by Renzo Gorio, and that story was produced by Adiza Egan. When Snap Judgment returns, we're going to show you how exactly not to play baseball when the Down with the Chip episode continues. Right after this short break, stay tuned. Amongst the 2016 election craziness, the stump speeches, the tweets, what is really going on? What does it take to win the most powerful job in the world? You can't understand today's candidates without listening to yesterday's. What do you know about Shirley Chisholm, the black woman who ran for president in 1972 and paved the way for both Obama and Hillary? Seriously, she is the boss. Do you know what Howard Dean thinks went wrong with his campaign? Or how George Bush beat John McCain in the primaries? Learn about the strategic choices and human moments that determine who wins and who loses this blood sport we call presidential elections.
The Contenders. 16 for 16 is a new series from my favorite, stay interesting source, Ozzy, airing on PBS, starting Tuesday, September 13th at 8 p.m. 9 Central, and every consecutive Tuesday leading up to the election. Learn more at Ozzy, OZY.com. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Down with the Ship episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we know something bad is going to happen, but we're not going to let that stop us. Our next story comes from a dear friend of the show, Tara Clancy, and was recorded live at Sideshow Goshko.
It's the last inning of the game. We are down by one, two outs, no men on, no men anywhere. We are 11-year-old girls. We are playing softball. All right, so I'm in the dugout, pacing back and forth, and I'm watching as Michelle, who is the best player on our team, is making her way towards the plate. All right, now, because this is the Catholic Youth Organization League, we are not called like, you know, the such and such Tomcats or the such and such Bulldogs. We are just St. Gregory the Great. yes. period. In this game, we are playing our biggest rivals, who are called, I get this, Immaculate Conception. As in, it is us versus the greatest freaking miracle of all time. Got a prayer, you know. So Michelle is like, you know, she is like hopping on the balls of her feet, and she's, you know, helicoptering the bat over her head. You know, she is approaching the plate like this is, you know, the World Series. This is not Yankee Stadium. This is not even a baseball field. This is basically a parking lot. It is a blacktop schoolyard field way, way out in Queens. And we play here for no other reason than we are girls. Really. All of the boys in the CYO play on dirt. And all of the girls play on asphalt. And this is just how it is. This is how it has always been. And we are young, but we are not too young to realize, you know, that this is some serious All right. So now Michelle is like continues making her way up towards the plate. And the last thing she does is she stops and she turns and she looks like at the handful of dads that hang out behind the backstop. Now, my father comes to every single game, but Michelle's does not. And so all of a sudden I see her kind of stop and shock on her face because there he is. Her dad. Now, he was actually like a sweetheart of a guy, but a serious alcoholic. She sees him, and her face lights up, and he smiles, and he does the old, you can do it fist pump. And that's all it takes. Michelle turns. She stamps into the box. She proceeds to smack the very first pitch into left field for a double. Now Michelle's on second base, and the pitcher goes to wind up, and Michelle takes off to steal third, and she is like half the way there when the catcher takes the ball, wings it to the third baseman, and it should be game over. But then Michelle does something that nobody there that day, nobody on either team, had ever seen done before. She slides on asphalt. And it is like time stops and every single person in attendance goes, and now the third baseman is standing there and she's got the ball and she's in total shock. She doesn't even look down to tag her, right? And still it's going, you know, right? And now Michelle is down there and she rides on the ground finally, and now like we know she's alive, but it still goes, you know. And finally, the umpire, who is just like gobsmacked, runs out and he's like, safe? And whoosh, right? We go off the rails. I jump from the ground up into the chain link fence, like Spider-Man style, right? And I'm like 5 feet in the air. I got my fingers through the chain link. I am shaking this thing. I'm like, yeah! Meanwhile, now, all the girls on their team on the field literally just start taking off their gloves and like throwing it to the ground, you know, and they're like, you can't do that. You can't do that. And all the moms also come out and like, you can't do that. Right? Somebody's dad shows up and he's like, you know, that's disgusting. Who would tell a young girl to slide in the concrete, you know? Somebody's grandmother even says, God will punish you for this. Finally, the umps and the coaches and everybody comes out and they meet, you know, out on the mound and powwow and debate and whatever. And ultimately, they decide that there is no written rule against sliding on asphalt. So the call stays. But, you know, the practice is like officially deemed, you know, a pretty stupid idea. And we get some about, you know, like never doing it again. Now, it turns out, right, sliding on asphalt doesn't really involve much sliding, right? Like, you know, pretty much if you do it absolutely perfectly, you rip out the entire seat of your pants as you go and only the first layer of skin. Done wrong, you know, you need like upwards of a dozen stitches, you know, and either way, you get a bruise the size of Connecticut. But either way, no matter how you do it, it works every single time because nobody expects you to be stupid enough to try, right? And I know that for a fact because following this game, pretty much every single girl on my team would go on to do it. In fact, like, we couldn't wait, you know? Like, you know how, like, Girl Scouts, like, collect those little triangle patches for, like, accomplishments, you know, like, kite making or something, and there's a little picture of a kite on it, right? Okay, like, this was me. I wanted a patch, you know? I wanted a patch with a little bloody leg on it, you know? The next game comes around and we are like, we're just out of our minds. Like literally anytime one of us get on base, right? All the rest of us just start, you know, just start cheering. You know, we're like, do it, do it, do it. It's like, you're not at church league softball anymore. You're like at a cage fight, man. It's like MMA. We're like, ah! We're like taking tin cans and squashing them into our foreheads, you know? And I'm like dying. I cannot wait for my chance, right? And so finally, here it is. I am on second base. Somebody whacks one out into right field. I start running for third. The third base coach is like holding me off. I'm like, hell no. I round the base. I'm heading for home, right? I got my head down. I'm in like this full-on sprint, you know? And I get like a couple steps, you know, away from home plate. And I just look up and I watch as the catcher catches the ball, right? I'm done for. But I'm like, screw it. I jump up into the air. I literally dive over the catcher head first, full on swan dive. And then I come down head first. Bang, blackout. When I come to, my father is standing there over me, and he is, like, waving, you know, two fingers in front of my face, and he's got, like, you know, steam is coming out of his ears, and but I've got, like, this big smile, you know? And I'm like, so? And he's like, well, you know, look, I think it's probably only, you know, like a mild concussion, you know? And I'm like, no, 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 so? And he's like, what? Oh, for Pete's sake, you know, he's like, you're safe. You were safe, you jerk. This is a little postscript. Turns out this year, it is now 23 years later. So it took 23 years. This year, 23 years later, for the first time ever, the CYO finally righted this wrong. And just this past softball season, all little girls in Brooklyn and Queens played on dirt. Thank you.
Tara Clancy. She's a writer, performer, and big news. Tara's got a brand new book just hot off the presses. It's called The Clancys of Queens. And we are so proud of Tara. Get your own copy right now. You will thank me later. We'll have a link at taraclancy.com or snapjudgment.org. It's about that time. But before I continue, please note, Spooked 7 is coming. The most terrifying episode of Snap Judgment ever made. I'm scared even talking about it. Let the record reflect. For the countdown to the all-new Spooked 7 episode, we're dropping exclusive podcast-only scary specials. Subscribe to the Snap Judgment podcast right now so you don't miss out. SnapJudgment.org. Snap is produced by the team that never gets wet. Please make some commotion for the Uber producer, Mark Ristich. First mate, Pat Rafi Miller. Anna Sussman, Joe Rosenberg, Davey Kim, Nancy Lopez, Liz Mack, Renzo Gorio, Adiza Egan. Chef services by Leon Morimoto, Teo Ducat. And the Kids Club is run today by Jasmine Aguilera. And did you know that Snap Live is on tour? Minneapolis, San Francisco, Detroit, Chicago. Listen to me when I tell you, the show is made of fire and magic. Don't be sad you missed it. Be happy you came. Information at snapjudgment.org. And even though this is not the news, in fact, you could go on a vacation cruise ship, leave the water on in your bathroom, inadvertently sink the boat, only to be rescued by a guitar player, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.